Hi there, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial, bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more powerfully minded life. Positively and powerfully. In the studio, of course, with me, Ben Starr and Julian Joyeau.
Hey there.
And a special guest in here today with us, Dr. Catherine Good. Dr. Catherine Good comes to my attention from people who have taken classes with her at CUNY, C-U-N-Y, right? And the classes they take are in social psychology, and some of the reports that come back to me are kind of fascinating about the way they are learning. So I wanted to bring you in directly, Catherine, if you don't mind. Let's start off with a very simple definition. What is social psychology?
Well, social psychology is the study of how other people can affect our thoughts and our behaviors and our actions, either the imagined presence or the actual presence of others.
The imagined presence or the actual presence of others. So in social psychology, we learn how, give me a little more definition of that.
Well, we can learn how our own behaviors might be impacted by the attitudes that we hold towards others. It's very relevant currently as we look at what has happened in Ferguson, Missouri. We can understand some of those events through the perspective of stereotypes and prejudice, for example, and to better understand what may have driven everyone's behavior in that situation.
Well, what happens in stereotypes and prejudice? Now, this is, like you said to me earlier, I'm not a specialist in that, but give me the best description you have.
I'm sorry, I don't understand the question. Of stereotyping and prejudice?
Yes.
Stereotyping is this idea that we categorize people based on a set of attitudes and beliefs that we may hold about them, that is generalized from the larger group and then can direct our behaviors and our attitudes towards individuals within that group. So, for example, you may hold the stereotype that women are not as capable as men in mathematics, and that might then drive your behavior towards both your female and your male students in a math class.
And how would that make me behave if I believe that? I would not ask them to add up the scores?
You might have lower expectations of your female students. If there's a subjective judgment that you as an instructor have that you're able to make towards a student, you may be driven by your stereotypes of lower expectations for those female students. And then that can also impact your own behavior towards those students as well. The type of feedback you give them, the types of opportunities you may give them, whether or not you give them encouragement to continue in the domain. It has lots of implications for how we respond to others.
Have you had a long time battle in teaching this and trying to get people to understand that this exists?
Well, I don't know that I would call it a long time battle, but what I will say is that people tend to be very resistant to the idea that they might hold stereotyped beliefs about others or that they might be behaving in either racist or sexist ways. We all like to think of ourselves as very egalitarian, that we perceive others in a very equitable way. And so presented with evidence that we might actually be behaving and thinking and responding to others that is driven by either explicit or maybe even implicit biases threatens us in some way. So I would say that the battle I find with students is to get them to understand that even though you are an enlightened individual, you are still susceptible to the biases, the implicit biases that are prevalent in our society, and that those can therefore drive your own behavior.
Great. You know, so then you step in a room with three men, and we're doing this radio program. You think that any of those biases exist in such a way that you feel it automatically?
Oh, you mean me, myself?
Yeah, you yourself.
Right here.
Yeah, we three guys. I didn't realize the difference.
Well, I would say if we were going to be discussing, let's say, mathematics, for example, I might be feeling a little pressure, wondering whether or not you have lower expectations of me based on that stereotype. And the concern that I have that I might be behaving, therefore, in a way that would fulfill the stereotype could, ironically, actually undermine my performance and make me actually fulfill that stereotype, both in my own eyes and in yours.
So we sometimes fulfill the stereotype by undermining ourselves.
Something that's maybe more meaningful, for example, we could take another group. African Americans are stereotyped, let's say, to be criminals. If you are an African American man walking down the street, and a police officer is walking towards you, you may be concerned and wondered whether or not that police officer is going to be holding biases about you and wondering whether or not you, in fact, have committed a crime.
Automatic concern because you're...
Automatic concern, exactly.
You're walking down the street. Well, if you're a woman walking down the street and you see a man lurking off on the side, you have automatic concerns, don't you?
You do have automatic concerns, exactly. You may be concerned that that person is going to cause you some sort of harm. The case about the African-American man, however, is a little different because here... from his perspective, not from the police officer's perspective, but from his perspective, he may now be motivated to behave in a very non-threatening way. He wants to make sure he's presenting himself in a way that could not possibly be construed as criminal. That very act of trying extra hard not to behave in line with the stereotype can ironically cause you to behave in exactly the ways that the other person could perceive then in line with the stereotype.
Like a countertransference. It's like it's working back from the very thing you put out. What is that? Does the same thing work with the woman, the male-female thing? A woman's walking down the street. She sees a man lurking. He has to act in a
That's
way
right.
to be non-threatening.
Right. So he, in that situation, he's the one who is the target of the stereotype. So mm-hmm. he might find himself really wanting to convey to this woman who's on the street that he's not going to harm her. But in those actions, he may actually be giving off cues, in fact, that make him seem suspect.
Yeah, he may act weird.
He may act weird.
Maybe overly friendly.
Yeah, I
to
actually...
To try to assuage that feeling.
Perhaps overly friendly.
I forget where I read this, but there was a story about an African-American male who fits that very stereotype, tall, threatening by stereotypical standards, and he would whistle Vivaldi.
Right.
Have you heard about this story?
I have, in fact, right. So there's a book out by Claude Steele called Whistling Vivaldi, mm-hmm. in fact, where he discusses this concept. In social psychology, this concept is referred to as stereotype threat. It's the idea that you are a target of a negative stereotype. That stereotype becomes threatening to you in some way, that you might actually fulfill it. And you're working really extra hard to portray yourselves in ways that are not going to fulfill that stereotype. The act of trying to... not behave stereotypically can have these ironic effects that can lead to the very behavior that you're trying not to fulfill. And this concept, this idea of stereotype threat, can affect anybody. It can affect black people who are stereotyped perhaps to be less intellectually capable than whites. It could perhaps even affect individuals who face the stereotype of criminality. So you're working hard to dispel the stereotype, but in fact it could... undermine your processes that would lead you to therefore behave in those anti-stereotypic ways.
Our guest, I'll remind you, is Dr. Catherine Good, Associate Professor of Psychology at Baruch College and the Graduate Center. Catherine, we were talking about stereotyping, and Julian asks a very important question about profiling and stereotyping. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm just interested... being of, I'm half Asian descent, and growing up in America, I see around me a strange attitude towards Asian stereotypes. And I know, and I don't mean to discount any other stereotypes at all, or not discount stereotypes, but you know what I'm saying. I just am interested in your opinion of how it's addressed, and if it's similar to the American stereotype, or... what's your feeling about that?
Well, I think I'm going to put it back on you as somebody who might be living this experience. What have you actually experienced, and what do you see are the expectations that you feel placed on you because
that's
of your
not
background?
Fair. It's not fair because he's too good looking.
He's too good looking.
You see, he's an actor, and he's such a good looking actor, and he's so smart that he doesn't get many of the prejudices that would naturally hit your culture. So you're saying there are certain things that are targeted as... You know, anybody who is...
Well, I mean, I have dealt with it. I mean, it's definitely not to the point that I have friends that are full Chinese or full Japanese, full
Korean.
What
do they deal with?
And they deal with, I mean, the main one being, are you good at math, for example? That's the quick go-to for everybody. So anytime somebody is Asian... quickly in school, you'll say, oh, can you help me with my math homework? Oh, can you do this? And it definitely, and I got the pressure from it too, growing up. You get this pressure that you have to be really good at math. And I ended up being quite good at math, but I don't know, it's, I don't know where it came from, but it wasn't necessarily for my love of math, I guess I could say.
Well, I think it's really interesting, and I'll give you some examples from research that we can maybe use for fodder for our discussion. The idea is that it's your identity. There's something about your identity that carries with it cultural stereotypes. In your case, you have part of your identity is as an Asian male, and people expect you to be good in math. Interestingly, there's this phenomena called stereotype lift, that when you are the benefit of a positive stereotype, that actually can improve your performance on a test.
Give me an example of that, if you would, Catherine.
Well, for example, being reminded of your Asian background and then being asked to perform on a math test can actually elevate your performance on that test, as opposed to if a woman is reminded of her gender, of her female status, the negative stereotype that she's not expected to do as well as men can decrease her performance on the math test. And it's interesting when you have individuals who share dual identities. So we can talk about the case of Asian women, right? So on the one hand, they're stereotyped to not be capable in math. On the other hand, because they are of Asian background, they're stereotyped that they are capable in math. So what might you predict would happen?
Do they feel torn inside?
Perhaps they feel torn. And what we have shown through research is that depending on which part of their identity sort of comes to mind and is made salient, brings with it the whole host of stereotypes related to that identity and therefore the related performance. So if you remind Asian women of their Asian status, their performance on the math test goes up. If you remind Asian women of their gender, their performance on the math test goes
down.
Amazing. So the fact that you are an Asian male, you're sort of getting the benefit of both stereotypes, that because you're male, you're supposed to do well. Because you're Asian, you're supposed to do well. And I thought it was interesting, as you said, that you actually did do well in math.
Oh, always.
Not because of your love of math, as you said, and you're not sure why. Part of it might be because you received implicit supports, encouragement, expectations for your high performance. And because those expectations were there, you fulfilled those expectations in the positive way.
Yeah, but can you drive?
I actually have no ability to drive.
So. No ability to drive, right? We have that problem.
We would argue through this research that by entering that stereotype that Asians are bad drivers, if we were then to give you a simulated driving test, you would perform worse on it, perhaps because you're striving so hard to prove Armand wrong that Asians are not good drivers.
Well, I asked was, could he drive?
Could you drive?
I didn't say he's wrong.
But that's not fair either, because Julian spent his whole life in Manhattan, so, you know, it's tough to get a lot of experience driving.
Can you drive, Ben?
I can drive.
Oh.
All other things being held equal, you would do worse on that driving test, being reminded of the Asian stereotype that Asians can't drive. That's sort of the point.
Yeah.
So Catherine, in your class now, you have a class of how many students? 100 students?
My social psychology class right now is approximately 40 students. In the past, it's been as many as 100.
When you have all of these students now, right now there's a large, large influence of Asian people, isn't there, in the school itself?
Baruch does have a large Asian population, yes.
And is the majority of your class Asian population?
A majority.
A big piece.
Yes.
A big piece. Do you have anything that you say that is informed, you know, you're informing them in some way? Does it make, are there questions that they have in particular that they would point at you and ask about?
Well, I think the point that I try to make to my students, particularly when we talk about stereotypes, is that every individual has some part of their identity that could potentially have to push against a negative stereotype, and that nobody is immune from it. And therefore, in that way, they're all in the same boat. They may be targets of different stereotypes, but no matter what your identity is, there's something about your social identity that, depending on the situation you find yourself in, could make that stereotype relevant, and therefore you might have something that you were worried about fulfilling.
Well, if your stereotype includes some cultural prejudice, right, wouldn't that be a part of it? For example, whether you have excess weight or underweight makes a big difference.
Oh, absolutely.
For the Asian culture, right? But it doesn't make so much of a difference to the Italian culture.
I don't think I know the stereotype related to weight and culture.
What is a stereotype related to weight and culture? You don't know about that one?
No, I don't, actually. Yeah, you'll have to enlighten me.
Well, most, as I understand it, most Asians find that weight, overweight, fat, is a horrible thing to have.
One of the main reasons that happens is because, in general, I mean, I was just in Taiwan. It's body type-wise, as an Asian person, it's more common to be very, very slim.
So very
I can
slim.
Imagine that stereotype existing.
And compulsively sure. slim. I mean, to a point where you just absolutely can't afford to have a single extra pound on you. And if you did have it, you'd be drummed out. You don't know of this.
Oh, I did not know that it was specific so much to the Asian culture. But I do know that fatism is prevalent in this culture as well.
What about stereotypes, for example, related to workplace? For instance, you teach in a public university, and I'm a graduate of also a CUNY school at Queens College. What about, for example, the difference between, you know, all things being equal on a resume, a guy or a girl who graduated from a CUNY school versus an Ivy League school?
Well, I think that's really interesting. So there certainly are stereotypes about what is the quality of education you might get from a prestigious university versus a less prestigious university. And perhaps you feel like you have to work extra hard to prove to your employer or your potential employer that you're capable, that you learned a lot, that you're going to have something of value to bring. That extra drive and motivation to do your best and to disprove the stereotype that the CUNY students perhaps are not as capable as the Harvard students might actually lead you to behave in a way that is to tank on your interview, perhaps. Right? Like
right.
You're really wanting to show them that you're doing a great job and that extra effort that you're putting into the task could be perceived as overreaching or as desperate.
A sort of self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yep, perhaps. Maybe your voice conveys nervousness because you really want to show them that you're capable. So this is one way that that stereotype can undermine you. And then, in fact, the interviewer might perceive you as less capable because they're just picking up on something that doesn't quite seem natural and relaxed. I mean, if you're in a performance situation, what would you rather have? How would you rather go into that situation? With a relaxed concentration where you're really focused on the questions that the person is asking you, or with a little bit of anxiety about, well, I'm going to focus on these questions, but I also really want to demonstrate that I'm capable. And I know that the guy sitting next to me or who's coming in for the interview right after me is from Harvard, and I want to do better than him.
I think there's definitely elements of both. I mean, you want to be relaxed, but maybe not too relaxed.
Well, certainly. But it's the idea that the other person doesn't have to overcome that negative perception about their educational background. So they have a leg up ever so subtly.
Well, for the record, I'm super proud to be a CUNY grad, and I had great professors at Queens College. So
yeah, CUNY is a great institution.
I think there's really it's about what you put into your education versus a brand name.
Catherine, let me ask you about prejudice now. Almost all the prejudice I've ever seen was passed down through generations. You know, so if your father hated something and your grandfather hated something and your great-grandfather hated something, you have a tendency to hate the same thing. What is the root of most prejudice?
Oh, the root of prejudice, that's the big question. We could have a whole show, or you could have a whole show on this issue. The root of prejudice is not so simple. I think you're absolutely right that it is taught. But it's not the case that you have to have direct experience with a target of an outgroup in order to hold prejudiced beliefs. It's conveyed to us through media, through culture, through status differentials. So it's taught in various ways, not just through the family.
I had a very interesting experience during the 60s. Remember the 60s? No, it was the 70s. I was working in Wall Street during the Vietnam War protests, and there were hard hats. People wearing hard hats who would be, as we would be marching by. Now, I both worked in Wall Street and I was on the march at the same time. They were throwing bricks off the buildings down to the crowd. And they were killing some people. Some people were dying. So I was able to gather the head of the union and the head of the union and the business people and the people doing the march together in a room. And I was able to get them in a room to try to get them to discuss. I was also a psychology student at the time, and I thought I was saving the world. So I got them to get to the bottom of the issue. What is the bottom of this? Why do you guys, hard hats, hate these kids for protesting? What if they're right? And he said, but if they're right, then my father wasn't. And he said, and neither is my mother. He said, if they're right, my family is wrong. And that was a big attachment. You know how I got them all to agree to sit down? I served lunch. You know what I served? Peanut butter and jelly. they all loved it.
So I think that's really interesting. So just so I'm clear, you were able to bring representatives from both groups together,
yes,
and you served them in a peanut butter and jelly lunch.
Yep.
All three groups. Can you tell us a little bit more about the dynamic that happened within that?
Yeah, I just figured within that, everybody of any group as a child liked peanut butter and jelly.
It's the great equalizer.
You just can't go wrong, right? All right, what do
Absolutely.
We got here to eat? You know, we're going to eat salad now. We got peanut butter and jelly. All right, that's all we have. And everybody was okay with it, and they all laughed at it. They all had a good time. It was a great equalizer.
So you actually showed quite a bit of insight there. I don't know if you're aware of this. But
I'm a smart guy.
You are a smart man. One of the ways that we can reduce prejudice is through contact. So to have contact with people from the group that you hold these prejudice beliefs about is one of the crucial ways that we can help reduce prejudice. But it's
right.
not just contact, right? We have seen lessons from the desegregation of the South that simply integrating schools did not necessarily lead to reductions in stereotypes and prejudice and racist attitudes. But the peanut butter and jelly sandwich here was the great equalizer for you, right? So you had equal status contact. So everybody who came around at the table held the same position of power and influence. And that was sort of symbolized in the serving of your lunch of this peanut butter and jelly sandwich. Mm. So equal status contact is one of the sort of the tried and true methods that we can help reduce some prejudiced beliefs.
Oh, thank you. I'm going to send you a photograph that shows what happened as it was happening.
And can I ask you the second question then? What was the goal of the conversation?
The goal of the conversation was to get them to stop throwing the bricks down on these poor kids' heads. And so the kids, when they were sitting, you know, when we had the head of the protesters up there, they saw him as human. They said, oh, we don't really want to hurt you.
Right.
We're not trying to hurt you. You know, we were just trying to protest. We're trying to break up the fight. But why do you want to break up the fight? Because we must believe that Nixon and my family and everybody is telling the truth. So it was really a break with truth itself. Our guest, the brilliant Dr. Catherine Good, associate professor of psychology at Baruch College, talking to us about stereotypes and prejudice. And we're going to have her back because she really does contribute a great deal. I want to thank you for coming by, Catherine.
Thank
this
you
is
for
a last
me.
Minute notice, huh? We
thank
got you.
You
in here. You did terrific. You did terrific. We'll be back with you in just a little bit, my friends. You know, in the view of stereotypes, I saw an interesting article by David Brooks in the New York Times yesterday, an article called The Cop Mind. And looking, I shared it with Ben and with Julian, and he talks about how early on he saw an amazing variety of police officers. He said they spend most of their time in the chaotic and depressing outer ring of society, busting up domestic violence disputes, dealing with drunks and drug addicts, coming upon fatal car crashes, managing conflicts and large and small. Brooks said that the police ride an emotional and biochemical roller coaster. They experience moments of intense action and alertness, followed by emotional crashes marked by exhaustion and isolation. Try to get what that's like. The roller coaster of action, alertness, exhaustion, and isolation. They become hypervigilant. Surrounded by crime all day, some come to perceive that society is more threatening than it really is.
Absolutely, Armand. And to cope with this, they emotionally armor themselves. Many cops develop a cynical and sort of hard-edged sense of humor. That's an attempt to really insulate themselves from the pain associated with the job. Whether that's the pain of seeing a dead child or the body of a young girl that they arrived too late to save.
Right, and many of us see police as relatively invulnerable as they patrol the streets. I mean, the police themselves don't perceive themselves as invulnerable. I mean, Brooks points out, it's a common myth that police officers approach conflicts with a feeling of power. After all, they are armed, they represent the state, and they're specially trained and backed up by an army of police.
In reality, an officer's gun is almost always going to be a liability.
because a suspect can grab it in a confrontation or a scuffle.
Officers are usually at a disadvantage because they have to intervene on someone else's turf.
And they have to worry that bystanders might become involved either by helping someone the officer has to confront or later on second-guessing the officer's conduct.
We're sharing with you highlights from A Cop Mind, an opinion piece in yesterday's New York Times by David Brooks. In many places, he says, a self-supporting and insular police culture develops. In this culture, no one understands police work except fellow officers. It's a brotherhood. It's much like the military. The training in the academy is useless. To do the job, you've got to bend the rules and understand the law of the jungle. The world is divided into two sorts of people, the police and the criminals.
Right, and they live a dual life of both boredom and stress. Brooks points out life expectancy for police is lower than for the general population. Cops suffer disproportionately from peptic ulcers, back disorders, and heart disease. In one study, suicide rates were 3 times higher among cops than other municipal workers. Other studies have found that somewhere between 7% and 19% of police suffer from PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder.
The effect is usually harsh on those who've been involved in shootings. It's an interesting thing about shootings. 2/3 of the officers who've been involved in actual shootings suffer moderate or severe emotional problems. 70% of the police leave within 7 years of the incident. Most cops know they walk a dangerous line between necessary and excessive force. According to one National Institute of Justice study, Brooks points out, more than 90% of the police officers surveyed said that it's wrong to respond to verbal abuse with force. 90% of them said that. Nonetheless, 15% of the police surveyed were aware that officers in their own department often do respond with excessive force. What is it that makes this happen? How does it happen? Why do the police suddenly feel like it's just a war between us and the world out there, and we have to protect ourselves and we have to protect each other? What have we developed in society? This is the kind of question that we have to address. The police are not the enemy. The police are us. It's the other side of us. We developed a world in which almost everybody is thinking, how can I get by on the system that exists? And almost everyone will take advantage of any opportunity that they could run into. Then you have the people on the other side who are trying to arrest you for selling cigarettes that you shouldn't be legally selling. And what that goes into, what that boils down to, because what we saw in that incident was not an incident of one person and one cop. We saw the world at work. We saw the examining what the level of injustice was, and we saw the overreaction to it. How often do you overreact? How often have you found yourself on the other side of justice yourself? How often have you asked yourself, am I being just or am I being not just? Am I being right or am I being not wrong? What about the cop inside you? This is what we have to examine. By just pointing them out and putting them on the other side, sure, there's a lot of corrections to be done, but we have to look at the policeman inside us. So I'm going to open the phones to get some calls from you to talk about the policeman inside you. What part of you is a cop? What part of you feels that you have the right to determine what's just and what's not just? This is in everybody. Our telephone number here is 212-957-2729. 212-957-29. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, I want to hear your phone calls. 212-957-2729. The cop inside you.
One of these days, things ain't gonna change. One of these days, things ain't gonna change. Time now, baby. After a while, gonna do mine, gonna be mine. One of these days, baby, I'm moaning, droning, baby.
Change, change. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. We're at a time of change, my friends. Aren't we always at a time of change? A time of shifting. We were speaking with Catherine Good, Professor Catherine Good, just earlier in the program, about stereotyping and some of the things that happen in social psychology. And then I was reading highlights from David Brooks' article on Cop Mind, which was an opinion piece yesterday in yesterday's New York Times. What I got down to as I listened to it, and I hear the opinions and the irate callers and a lot of the listeners were saying, you know, we've just got to persecute the police and hold them up. Well, maybe that's true. Maybe that's what we've got to do. But what I'm pointing to is the policeman inside everybody. Everybody has a feeling somewhere that they know right from wrong, and everybody kind of looks the same way. I'm right, you're wrong. What I look for on The Positive Mind is somebody could say, I'm neither right nor wrong, I want to learn. Let's take some of our callers. We're probably going to hear from some very angry people, but, you know, understandably, there's a policeman in everyone. 212-957-2729. Let's hear from Jason. Hi, Jason, you're on the air.
Hi, Armand. Thank you for taking my call. And as usual, a very interesting topic, and self-examination is always the best examination. So I would like to get right into it, Armand. One of the things that I learned, and you're in a unique position here because you're talking to someone who actually does community policing. I'm a member of the FOI, and that's one of the brothers with the bow ties that follow Minister Farrakhan that are often in our community doing the work for free that many police officers say that they do. And we generally use love and compassion instead of billy clubs and guns.
So you're a cop with a different kind of weapon, right? Jason, you're a cop with a different kind of weapon. You got love and understanding in place of a baton and a gun.
That's correct. And in many instances, I personally have disarmed people that are on the verge of either suicide or homicide. Personally have done it. I've been a member of the FOI for over 30 years, and to this day, nothing but love for my people, love for the community. And
so what can you teach me about what you had to face inside yourself to be able to do this without anger.
Right. When I was 17, I joined the Nation. And this is a time of awakening in young men. And I was very, very angry with white society. And it was an internal thing that I said, I want to, instead of looking to lash out, I would like to improve myself. And the best thing that I saw in my community coming up was the Nation. And I decided to dedicate my life to following those teachings. Okay. In it, it's not just improving self. That's one thing. But it's a great deal of community outreach that has to go along. You often see the brothers with the Final Call newspaper. It's not just a salesman or the bean pie. It's not just to be a salesman, but it's as a way to open up dialogue to members of the community. It's, you know, I have something, let's talk about it.
Okay, and Jason, hold on. Before we get too far on that, I understand what you're saying, and it's a very interesting thing, but we only have a short time to take calls.
Right.
And what
okay,
I want to get from you, let me tell you,
Jason. Every police officer, and that's the intense amount of corruption, not in the regular peer-to-peer policing, but those that are up top, those that are calling the shots at one police plaza and the one police plazas throughout the country, we could not have that inordinate amount of violence in our community without an inordinate amount of corruption from up top.
Jason, I've always seen corruption up top. I see it in every corporate entity. I see it in every business. I see it even with the doctors and the physicians and the dentists. There's always some kind of guy who's screwing somebody else. But,
right, but
my question, let me talk to you. Let me talk to you.
The regular beat cop is squeezed between that corruption upstairs and his own sense of self.
I understand. Let me ask you this. You have been corrupted yourself. You have had to face the piece of you that would have used your own corruption, and you've had to face it. There was some time when you saw the easy out, and you saw the hard out. And something changed you, and I'm going to guarantee you the thing that changed you was the love of another human.
Absolutely.
Who
Absolutely.
Was it? Who was it that gave you that? You still there, Jason?
Yes, I'm still here. You know,
who was it? Who was it? Yeah, I know I did. Who?
If you don't reach outside of yourself sometime and think about your
who reached out to you
circumstances, you're going to be frustrated.
Who reached out to you, Jason? Jason, who reached out to you?
Another brother by the name of Kim, at that time Kim X. He's now Kim Muhammad, and he reached out to me. As a matter of fact, I'll tell you how we met.
Wait! We don't have that time.
Rob him.
I want to thank him. I want to thank him for reaching out to you, for giving us you. And you want to thank him publicly right now, right?
I always do. Whenever I see him, I greet him with a great big hug and love for him and his family to this very day. And there's so many brothers that would say the same thing of me because I had to reach out to other brothers just like someone reached out
Jason,
to me.
Thank you very much for calling in. Thank you,
Armand. Always love the show.
Thank you. 212-957-2729. 212-957-2729. It's amazing. Amazing to be able to hear from people who feel so spirited in so many ways. But we have this question. We have this question about the inside of us. The part of us that feels that we're a justice, that we're right, and the other guy is wrong. Corruption? It's been every part of the universe, you know? It's in the bottom of the seas. It's everywhere you look. It's in plants. It's fungus. It's everything you could imagine. There's something that's going to live on corruption. Living a life of integrity, boy, that's a tough thing in this world. Very tough.
Absolutely, Armand. I think it's important to have this conversation because, like you say, there's a part of us inside that always wants to make ourselves right at the expense of others around us. And I think that really relates to sort of the pieces of that article that we heard earlier in the show.
Let's take another call. Quajo, you're on the line. This is Armand DeMille.
Yes. The police officer in me is that I have a gun. I have a gun, and I'm going to execute or exercise my racism by killing people of African descent, especially black men.
That's what you feel, huh?
That is correct.
Yeah.
And the police officer in me is that I will shoot and kill a 12-year-old boy with a toy-looking gun.
Yeah, yeah.
The police officer in me is that I'm a racist who is willing and ready to choke a black man to death. The police officer in me is a racist police officer who is ready and willing to walk through a dark alleyway with my gun drawn out, with my hand on the trigger to shoot and kill a black man whom I don't regard as a human being.
I hear you,
Quadro. That is the police officer in me.
Thank you. Thank you.
Mr. Brooks lives in a different world, and he has to know that.
Oh, sure he does. Thank you so much, Quadro. Thank you. Thank you. It's not exactly what I meant by the police officer inside of you, because I don't just mean incorporating what you know of police to be. I mean looking at the part of you that's got this sense of justice. It's so hard not to be critical of other people. You know, 212-957-2729, but I certainly was impassioned by hearing the tears behind Quadro as he showed his indignation. You know, 212-957-2729. We're taking your calls. This is Armand DeMille. Hi there, Rez.
Hi, Armand.
Hi there, Rez.
Hi. You referenced the cop within us. I've caught criminals in the act. That's, you know, I've actually caught people with weapons. But I think you mean the cop within us who judges others.
That's right.
And I think when people are intellectually dishonest, that kicks in, and from the president on down, we say, hey, that is wrong. And the cop within us says, judges that person is whether they're right or wrong. And a cop on the street knows in talking to someone whether they're lying to them or not, and that kicks in a lot with the police officer. So I have sympathy with police. You know, I called you before. That thing in Ferguson, that is a killer cop. The thing in Staten Island, you can see that on TV every day. They do that 1,000 times a day. To white, black, Hispanic, that is the police doing bad things to everybody. But in Ferguson, it was a cracker cop who killed a black kid. Believe me, that's what happened.
Let me ask you something, Rez. In you, you've had to confront this when it comes to your own rage, right? Can you? Because I hear you're a man of introspection. How do you deal with your rage? How do you deal with your anger and your indignation when you come face to face with something that frightens you?
Well, I call radio shows off, and I talk to the TV a lot, but you'd have to ask my partner. She just made me have a different opinion on how I deal with my rage.
So you have love in your life.
Yes, I do. I have a lot of love.
Now, this is a very important thing, because somehow people who have this inner policeman also have this inner isolation, you see, and they usually don't let in another hand to soothe them or be with them. So what I hear is, you know, what I'm hearing from you is, yes, you know, I face those things inside myself, but I've got somebody who actually cares about me, and that makes all the difference in the world.
Well, it certainly does, Armand, but, you know, I'd like to really know why it is that I stamp my feet, because I called you, you know, last week, and you, after I hung up, you sort of infantilized me and the movement and said, it feels good to stamp your feet, what is actually accomplished. And I'd really like to call you on that, Armand.
I don't remember what it was.
Well, we were talking about Ferguson, and I said, Armand, the only way you can get the attention of white people is burning things down. And you said, hey, that's really kind of, you know, over the... You didn't say that. It's over the line. But I got the feeling like you and your partner there sort of said, hey, well, that's what we felt when we were younger, but we got over that. We were anti-authoritarian. We were anti-the police. And the young man that you've got there sort of said, when I was younger, now, he's probably less than 40, and to me, he's still a young man. He's got a lot to learn. But, Armand, I don't get it, Armand. What's going on? Are you kind of giving up on protest?
No. What I'm giving up on is somebody who puts out an image of burning things down that other people will take literally. Mm-hmm. See, that's what I'm trying to put out. When I hear those things, like I hear somebody saying, I want to go out and shoot somebody, I want to temper that so that the minds who hear it literally don't go out and do it. So when you said burning things down, I was kind of tempering that. I was kind of saying, yeah, but you don't have to burn things down, even though we didn't have the time. And I don't mean to infantilize you, because certainly you're no infant, but I am.
Well, we're together in the playpen, Armin, and I thank you for your soothing talk.
Okay.
It's just I wouldn't throw the bomb, but I would be in the crowd and support people who are taking the risk. Because freedom goes to those who are willing to be bold. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
All right, Armin. Thanks very much for talking. If you want to get on to the next call,
I will, Rez. Thank you so much for calling back.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. 212. You know, that's the way they think up in White Plains. I wonder where he's from. 212-957-2729. I'm kidding. I knew he was from White Plains. 957-2729. This is Armand DeMille. Notice there are no women calling in. I'm curious about that. Maybe we could do something to get a woman to call in, you know? Hold on a second here. Let me press this other button. Hey, Chandra, you're on the line. I don't hear it.
Hello?
Hi, Chandra. There you are.
Okay. I'd like to say that the example that you're using to me is a bit, I think, not fair, because a police officer has a responsibility, because of the badge that they wear and because of the training that they have, that you are more than just a person judging somebody or judging somebody. You have to be extra careful. You are a professional. You're supposed to be trained to have self-control. You're supposed to be trained to be analytical, okay? And it seems to be it's like almost like black men are an endangered species. And I'd like to see how white people or white men would feel if that was happening to you guys. Whether you could,
Chandra,
make
you know,
it so simple.
Chandra,
okay,
I'm not
so
saying.
So the policeman in me says that you can't compare my emotions and how I judge people, because they have a responsibility and we all pay taxes, and so they're supposed to take care of all of us, not kill us.
You know, I fully agree with you. However, let's talk about the military. A soldier goes over to Iraq, they're given a gun. He's supposed to be a fair guy, but he's got a gun and he gets scared and he shoots anyway. And it's like scared people who are armed, you're right, they should be trained differently. Sure, they should be different. But inside every one of us, is this part of us that gets scared and reacts with fear.
But
that's,
you know,
how I see that.
Be,
that's
like
what I
said
see
before,
is all fear.
When you're a trained professional, when you're in Iraq, okay, you're in the army, you're supposed to kill people. When you're walking on the streets of any city and you're a police officer and you're supposed to take care of the public, you're not supposed to go out to kill. Okay?
I understand, Chandra.
People.
I agree
you
with
don't
you
have
completely.
To kill them. You can disable people. You don't have to kill them. So it's a whole different mindset that is going on with what's going on now. Totally different.
I agree with you completely.
Okay, have a good day.
Thank you, Chandra. Thank you. Sure. I wish everybody could step up to their higher self. Unfortunately, when you get scared, the lower self takes over, and that's what we're seeing.
It's true what you said, though, about the fear part in everybody that takes over and the lower self. I mean, yes, should police be better trained? Absolutely. But, I mean, at the end of the day, they're, you know, when we allow the fear to take over, that blocks out the ability to be sort of this compassionate, higher individual. And that's what we would want from everyone, not just police officers. I mean, the world would be a better place if we could get the most out of everyone on that level of compassion and being our best, highest self. But it's like you say, I think fear creeps in, and fear is a very powerful and crippling thing for many people who allow it to take over.
And that's all we see. Whenever we see these brutality, we're seeing the basis of fear. You know, so is there a better way to deal with fear? Is there a better way to train our police to deal with fear? That's another question. Then you have to train the military to deal with fear. Then you got to train the corporate enterprises to deal with fear. Everybody's kind of getting in there, taking care of themselves.
I remember during Occupy Wall Street, there was a picture of an NYPD officer and a woman who was one of the occupiers, and they were standing next to each other with their arms around each other, and she was holding a sign that said, "When the power of love is greater than the love of power, the world will know peace.
Hmm.
And this police officer was holding up a peace sign. And that had a lasting impact on me.
That was
an image that stayed with me from that.
212-957-2729. That is Ben Starr, by the way, and Julian Joiello, just to let you know the level of their... how old are you, Julian?
22
years old. How old are you, Ben?
27.
These guys, you know what I mean? They know so much more than me. 212-957-2729. Lisa, you're on the air. This is Armand DeMille.
Hi, Armand.
A soft voice.
I'm close to White Plains.
Ah.
Listen, you are so tricky, but this is why we listen to you, because you always make us bring it back to ourselves. And it's a tough question. So when I thought about it and you said the cop in me, the best way that I could relate it is to me being a mom and raising my kids. That's when the cop in me really comes out. I'm there to protect them. I'm there to guide them. I love them. But I'm also the most strictest disciplinarian. I don't want them to not do well in life. It scares me to think that they might end up not being good human beings, being rude, getting the wrong message from me. So the cop in me really comes out in this sense. I'm also the one that protects them. You know, as soon as I see any kind of danger, or I'm the first one there to take up their cause, even if they haven't done something right, but I can see both sides of it. So when I look at this, and I think this is something that we probably should keep talking about till tomorrow, because it's tough, that's how it comes out. That's what I see. I think it's a lot of it is different than what we see the police doing out there, because if we want to talk about fear, it's not a fear of, you know, oh, I'm afraid for my life with those cops. It's a deeper fear in our society that goes on out there. And that fear is the fear of black people doing well.
Mm-hmm.
It is a much deeper and a much more instinct. You've got people who are not usually very educated, not usually very rich, right, who decided to become cops. A lot of the profile of a cop is egotistical instead of humble. They escalate situations instead of diffuse situations. And really, and it's the history of it too, really is a way of...
Well, what do you feel? Do you feel a sympathy for that, or do you feel an antagonism towards it? What do you feel towards it?
Towards policemen?
Yeah.
I don't feel sympathy.
None?
It isn't that I don't feel none about, you know, not understanding it's a dangerous job and all of that stuff. But I think as an organization, as a system, as what I know about this country and history, I feel that I understand it, and I know it needs to be changed, and it needs to be turned upside down.
But I think, Kate, you know, I think you're saying the important thing, which is that there's a piece of us, Lisa, inside of ourselves that we have to examine. Because the disciplinarian inside ourselves is very close to the part that gets scared and acts out during this time. Now, I'm sure there are many, many things to be said about this. We're going to be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m. and probably take this to a different level. So we have to be going now. Lisa, thank you for calling in. Chandra, Rez, Quajo, Jason as well, thank you for your contributions. We will be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m. Send your comments to my website or send them to me at armand@thepositivemind.com. We'll be looking forward to it. Ben, thank you for being with us. Julian?
Absolutely. And yes, for the record, Armand knows much more than Julian and I. He's teaching us every day about all kinds of stuff.
Absolutely, absolutely. Thanks to be here again.
But I learned from them, too. Because imagine where you would be if you were just stuck in my age bracket and didn't have access to the youthful mind. What would that be like? I'd sell nutrition. 212-75. Be back with you tomorrow.